This is a conversation I've been looking forward to for a long time, and today we're going to be talking about Roman political theology and its influence on the New Testament. And James Valiant, in his book Creating Christ, gets into that heavily, and Robin Walsh also gets into that Greco-Roman influence on the New Testament in her book.
Titled The Origins of Early Christian Literature.
And I'm bringing these two together to talk about their ideas. They look at it in different ways, but also very similar ways. And that's why I think that today's discussion is very important.
I want to thank you, Jacob. The first thing I want to do is thank you for bringing this together, because I'm a huge admirer of Professor Walsh's work. You know that my great concern in this area of scholarship is that we place Christianity and the earliest Christian literature within the cultural and political context of its time, just as we do with every other body of literature or any other historical topic. We put it within its cultural and political context to greater understand the material. And I think that Professor Walsh has done yeoman's effort and has done a magnificent job. I'm a huge admirer of her work because it starts to reorient the field in exactly that way. I think there's little doubt of the truth of her thesis. I think it's she presents it in a very gentle, scholarly, but also very powerful and persuasive way that's kind of overwhelming. The Gospels fit when we, it's not as though they stand out. In certain ways, of course, obviously they're distinct, but they really do fit nicely. And it's clear that they were written by highly educated elites of the time. This is a sophisticated crunching of the philosophy of Plato and Philo and Hebrew literature. And when you compare it to, say, the works of Plutarch and Suetonius, you know, biographical works of that time, as well as a whole bunch of other material, it just stands out as sort of belonging to that time, certainly from a certain perspective, but it more fits in the time. And now we can greater understand this literature thanks to the work of Professor Walsh. So the first thing I wanted to do was praise her work and get everyone who's listening to us to go check it out. Please include a link to her book in the notes, Jacob. Because I think it's so important that all of our listeners should check it out, really.
I can't thank you enough. That's such a wonderful endorsement. I'm very flattered. So thank you for that. And I do see a lot of agreement insofar as our work tends to look for creating more contact between the context of these texts and what we know is going on politically, and also in terms of just ancient practices of things like reading and writing, and also the networks, the social networks that we see developing between. There's evidence that there's overlap and contact between what's going on among even the Roman elite, the Jewish elite, and what we might call the Christian elite, especially in the second century. So I think we'll have a fruitful conversation. And your work has done a lot to advance those lines of thought. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, yeah, and I guess just moving on to a point on that, your work invites us to consider what type of elite are we talking about in the Roman world in, say, the late first century and second century of the Common Era? And I'm not claiming that men like Josephus or Titus Flavius Clemens wrote any of it, certainly not making that claim. But what's interesting is that each of them represent the kind of elite that could have been behind this. In the case of Josephus, we have a highly educated Jewish historian who is, in his first work, The Jewish War, just flat out writing Roman propaganda. He's working for the Romans and writing propaganda.
Nobody has much choice.
No, right. But he's actually, what's interesting is that he'll marshal things like the Daniel son of man prophecy at the siege of Jerusalem, just as Mark 13 does, armies seen fighting in the clouds, and Josephus credibly reports it. He doesn't do it to support a claim about Jesus, but he does it to support his claim about Vespasian being the Jewish Messiah of prophecy, which is remarkable. He and Yohanan ben Zakkai, apparently leading Jewish figures of the period, are, as you point out, sort of politically compelled to acknowledge these Flavian claims. I think there was obvious political pressure on them, and to varying degrees. It seems like ben Zakkai was probably just being reluctant, whereas Josephus was an active propagandist for the Flavians. And then on the other hand, we have a pagan like Titus Flavius Clemens. Dio Cassius, the historian, reports that he was executed in the 90s for adopting a Jewish way of life. Now, not becoming a Jew outright, but here we have a member of the imperial family, an actual member of the imperial family who we're told is maybe a God-fearer. At least he's interested in Jewish monotheism, and he's a pagan. So it seems to me that the two very audiences of the New Testament, perhaps elite Jews who want to assimilate into the Roman Empire, men like Philo or Josephus, as well as pagans who are interested in Jewish monotheism, someone like Titus Flavius Clemens, are exactly the sort of elites. As I say, I'm not claiming either of them actually wrote any of this, but they're the categories of people that I think are give substance to your approach.
They're certainly the kind of authors, and at least in terms of, you know, social strata and where we might imagine someone being located socially, economically, if we want to use that terminology, I think that they set us on a path that creates some really interesting ways to do some comparative work, to think not only about what you're describing here in terms of the context of, you know, one thing that I think comes across in your work too, that I would like us to talk about briefly is, you know, when things happen, like we hear that some Jewish people are being expelled from Rome, say, what that tells us is that people are interested in Judean stuff. And how could you not be in the second century, especially in the Flavian era, when you have the Flavian amphitheater, when you have the, you know, Arch of Titus, when you have coins with the Judaea Capta? I mean, it's being circulated on all levels of society. And there's a great deal of interest in what not only happened in that war, but also what's going on with this very ancient protected tradition and in Judaism. And so I think that, you know, Philo, you mentioned, it's really interesting to me that Philo never mentions the Christians, although some people think that their reply could be, you know, a description of them, in part because, or doesn't mention, say, like Paul, I should say, specifically, because he is allied to that royal family by marriage. And so, you know, we sometimes have these ideas of what other scholars like Trolsenberg Peterson have called the Hellenistic Judaism divide. You know, you have the quote unquote pagans, you have the Jews, and, you know, the twain does not meet, right? But this is certainly not the case. So we need to, especially you mentioned God-fearers as well, you know, we need to understand that there would have been interest, not only interest, but people participating in things that we might recognize today as, say, Christianity, but even the quote unquote pagans interested in this Jewish stuff. And I think that by looking at the people who would have had the capacity, the training, the knowledge, the schooling to actually write the texts that become representative of what we call Christian origins, looking to some of the figures that you've mentioned makes a lot of sense.
Thank you. You know, we have the very first non-Christian or Jewish mention of Christians at all is in a letter from Pliny the Younger to the Emperor Trajan, right, written early in the second century. Yeah. One of the remarkable things about his notice is that he says that they come from all classes of society. He said, he's reporting to Emperor Trajan as the new governor of Bithynia, and he says, over here in Bithynia, this Christianity thing sort of reached its peak about 20 years earlier. That would put it in the early 90s, the Flavian era. And he said it involved all classes. So there, in the very first notice by a pagan historian of Christianity, we have a sort of a description of this new Christianity thing by the end of the first century involving all classes, including the elites that you mentioned.
It is interesting. John Poppenborg points out in his most recent book on Christ associations, that there's actually no senatorial sponsorship of early Christianity until, I think he says, the Severan period. So it is interesting, nonetheless, to see discourse about how this is a movement that people are interested in, widespread, the degree to which we can understand them being part of something we call Christianity. Some people are just kind of curious about other gods, you know. So, but then somebody like Lucian comes on along with Peregrinus. And so, you know, quite interesting that many of our early examples of quote unquote pagans interacting with Christianity are satire, complete misunderstanding.
Right.
Absolutely
correct. I mean, we have Justin Martyr in the middle of the second century, in effect, asking the emperor to persecute heretics. We have him making, in fact, he's drawing comparisons to the pagan religion and Christianity in the middle of the second century. Christians themselves are trying to understand their work in this wider pagan context. And, you know, it's remarkable because we're obviously also politically in the midst of a period of tremendous military and political turmoil. We have the first Jewish war from 66 to 70. We have, it really doesn't end until 73 in Masada. We have further disturbances, and then we have a second Bar Kokhba rebellion in the second century. And they appear to be religiously motivated, inspired by messianic prophecies, Torah Orthodox, militant, separatist, nationalist. And when you read the documents of the New Testament, it's hard not to see that the New Testament is sort of a critical response to precisely that kind of messianic Judaism. It is not Torah Orthodox. It is pro-peace. It is not nationalist. It is internationalist. And so if you go right down the, you know, Jesus says of a centurion that he's never seen such faith, not in any Jew, that this Roman centurion in this age of rebellion has more faith than any Jew is a remarkable statement in the Gospels. But we could go on and on like that. Jesus befriends tax collectors, says pay your taxes to Caesar, attacks the temple both morally and physically, sort of as a prologue to the Romans doing the same thing. And finally, of course, you've got the passion narrative itself in all four Gospels, which seems, and Bart Ehrman earlier, I had a discussion earlier this year with Bart Ehrman, again, thanks to Jacob, in which he conceded that the passion narrative in all four Gospels appears to be a political parable, a fiction designed to blame the Jews and exonerate the Romans for the crucifixion of Jesus, which is stunning.
I would push against that to some degree, because I think in its time, everyone was well aware that crucifixion was a Roman punishment. So despite what goes on in the dialogue of the passion narrative in terms of, you know, I know you've mentioned this before too, you know, we have in the Synoptic Gospels, the crowds, you know, encouraging Pilate to crucify Jesus. I think that audiences of that text would have still been aware that Pilate and crucifixion itself, just symbolically, crucifixion is a Roman punishment.
Very, very.
So I wouldn't, and also, you know, even though I subscribe to the idea, of course, that the Gospels, I believe as you do too, were written several generations after these events actually took place. So we're in a period where the temple has already fallen when the Gospels are written. Nonetheless, Jesus and his followers are, you know, good, observant Jewish followers. I mean, they go to the temple, they participate in temple cult, they follow Jewish law. And so I don't quite see the Gospels as arguing against a sort of messianic interpretation of Judaism that tends to be at least ascribed to certain groups within Judea. I mean, Thutis or John the Baptist, I mean, there are many other figures even before the Jewish War who also took on, you know, those kinds of roles. We have multiple sects that are also, you know, more or less engaged with the Roman way of doing things or not. And also, you know, it treats Judaism a little bit like it's monolithic in this period. It's really not. I mean, not all Jewish sects believe in something like even resurrection, right?
Right.
So I think that where we agree is that there does seem, at least to my mind, to be more of a Roman perspective represented in the Gospels. And that may be because these authors are themselves, you know, in Rome, perhaps. I mean, some people have made that argument, or at the very least are, you know, imbued in Greco-Roman philosophy and knowledge of the Roman world. So I see that, but I want to be careful about the idea that this means that there's some kind of, you know, great reaction to the Judaism of the characterizations that we make of.
Would you agree with, and I don't know if this is, if I'm even going outside your area where you're comfortable talking about, but many scholars have come to the position that you're absolutely right, that Jesus and his generation were good Torah Orthodox Jews. And it was Paul who really is the creator of the, he cites his own revelation, he makes intense arguments, but he never quotes Jesus on this topic. But it was Paul who sort of said, circumcision, that's really not necessary. All those strict dietary laws, maybe that's not necessary. Galatians, that argument in Galatians between Paul, where he confronts Cephas to his face and James is spying out our freedom in Christ, Paul seems to be the guy who came up with that Torah criticism within Christianity, but the Gospels certainly are reflecting it back on Jesus. Jesus will say things like, it's nothing you put into your body that defiles. A kind of a gross image. He says, what comes out of your body is what's pollution. And so although Paul could have quoted the Gospels had they existed, they didn't exist in Paul's time. He could have quoted Jesus, but actually, obviously, the Gospels are giving substance to Paul's innovation, his Torah criticism. And so the crucifixion, clearly a Roman thing, may have been a real historic fact that the Christians, however pro-Roman they might have been at some later stage, were stuck with. And that's exactly what they're trying to turn on its head. And having Pilate say he's innocent in all four Gospels, sort of like a political cartoon, wash his hands of it. The violent crowd, just like the rebels, are demanding not once, not twice, but three times, or even to the betrayal of Judas and the denial of Peter. It all starts to come to a single unified theme this is a Roman execution, but we Jews were the, and in fact, that's how all early Christians saw it. The Jewish war was a disaster for Jews. Why? God was punishing them for killing Jesus. And that's how Eusebius saw it, Origen saw it, all the first Christians who examined this issue. That's exact. In fact, one could almost see that theme implicitly in the Gospels. As you say, they were written after the Jewish war and sort of in light of that. And say Mark 13, as it sounds like a dire warning against rebellion, that it was ignored by his contemporaries, obviously. So it could be that something like the crucifixion is just a historical fact they were stuck with. And they sort of turned the original Jesus movement on its head, a Torah Orthodox. In fact, if Jesus had been so pro-peace and so pro-tax collector, the Romans probably would have given him a soapbox rather than crucify him. So it seems to me far more likely that the historical Jesus might have been a rebel that was crucified by the Romans precisely because he was perceived as one of these many rebels of the first century period, claiming to be king of the Jews. But that in the hands of Paul and later Christian writers, Jesus was sort of commandeered for their own theological and political ends. What would you think of that?
So that is my comfort zone. The fact that I wrote on the Gospels is a little bit funny because I did go to graduate school for Paul. So, but then, you know, I try to be a jack of all trades. So I view things a little bit differently. I mean, Paul, like Josephus, is one of our only, if not, these are our only two extant Pharisees, the writings of Pharisees that we have. In the ancient world. What I never see Paul, you know, he never calls himself a Christian. I never see him outright denying Judaism. What I see him doing is saying that he's essentially like Jonah. He's been chosen before his birth to be a prophet. And so God has selected him to usher in this new age that's coming, this coming kingdom that has been to him manifested in the fact that Jesus of Nazareth was resurrected according to his own testimony, because he knows this is true. He saw him, right?
Exactly.
Exactly. So, and that's all he knows. So there are a couple of things to untangle here. So let me start with Paul's, what we might call theology on this. Paul, you know, is often misunderstood, I think, in turn with this dichotomy of, law versus works, right? You hear that sometimes, or sort of divorced, because he ends up being this figurehead for Christian origins. He gets divorced from Judaism. I don't think he ever thought that. What he describes in his letters as he says that the Torah, that the law remains holy, that it remains spiritual or pneumatic in Greek, but that is a covenant between the Jewish God and the Jewish people. Now, he says that at the beginning of time, those that we now call Gentiles, non-Jews, were actually Jews, but they've fallen away to idols. And a certain number of them are going to come back into the fold. And what that requires is a new covenant, because that old covenant has been broken by the Gentiles. And that new covenant is going to be established through Christ Jesus. He always emphasizes Christ Jesus, because this is the Jesus of Nazareth who has now been reborn, resurrected. as Christ. And so it's that death and his resurrection, which is a defeat of death, one of the great evils of the world, that has established that new covenant between the Jewish God and the Gentiles to bring them back into the fold, not of Christianity, but back into the fold of Judaism. So when Paul says no need to circumcise, no need to follow dietary laws, I read that as a very practical matter. The covenant between the Jewish people and the Jewish God requires that, but this new covenant does not necessarily have to require that. And so I think that that is what Paul is trying to say, that things like Eucharist, participation in Eucharist, things like baptism, which he calls participating in Christ, you know, linking oneself, almost the baptism, I think, functions like the anointing that you would do for a baby, right? Pardon me. Or the anointing that you would do in an adoption. And he calls it, adopting, that these people who are being baptized are now the Gentiles are now co-heirs with Christ, that they're being baptized into a new lineage where the Jewish God is now their God. And so it's a brotherhood that they're establishing. I'd like to say sisterhood, but he never uses that word. It's a brotherhood. He's establishing, between Christ and these Gentiles. And so that new lineage goes back to the Jewish God. Paul never denies this. So to me, the Gentiles are effectively becoming what we might say Jews if we want to actually create those categories. They're not becoming Christians, at least in Paul's life,
I fully agree with that entire conception. I think the early Christians saw themselves as worshipers of the Jewish God and the fulfillment of all the Jewish prophecies.
I don't think that's a denial of Torah, though, because I think he thinks Torah predicts that these Gentiles are going to come back.
What's interesting, too, is that he does believe that the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus has had such metaphysical significance that circumcision doesn't even matter to Jews anymore.
I don't know about that. I wonder about that. I think that, if Paul, if he went to Mrs. Paul, whoever she met, and they had a baby. I'm guessing he would have circumcised the baby. You know what I mean? Like I guess we could have a debate about that. But
interesting question. Would Paul? Yeah,
he's from the house of Benjamin. Like right, if you're born into that lineage, you have a different covenant. If you're already an ethnic Judean. Right. If you're a Jewish person. So I'm not sure. Of course, with many things with Paul, it's a letter. We only have half the letter. He's only talking to Gentiles. This doesn't seem to have come up. But your point about Peter and James, the problem for Paul is that his claim to fame or his authority is coming purely from the fact that he's seeing the resurrected Jesus all the time. And Peter and James, all they have to say, they keep, I imagine how that conversation goes. And they'll be like, well, we followed the guy, we marched into Jerusalem with him. We were part of this movement. I always think of, the Martin Scorsese Last Temptation of Christ, and I got to remember the actor. But whenever I picture this, Harvey Keitel. Excuse me. I picture like Harvey Keitel. Yeah, he plays Peter. Like right. I picture like Harvey Keitel, like talking, And it's just like, he wasn't there. He wasn't there. So like, who is this guy? He's a self-proclaimed divination specialist who's seeing the resurrected Jesus and trying to institute, it's a Jewish movement. It was a Jewish movement in Jesus's time, as best we can tell, to the extent we can reconstruct a historical Jesus. Oh,
and even if go as far as my thesis might theoretically even take it, let's say the Roman government was involved. Even so, I would not imagine that this was aimed at anyone but those interested in the Jewish God already. This is a form of Judaism and was perceived as such. If anything, it perceived itself as modifying Judaism at the margins, as you say.
I think the one thing that changes, sorry to interrupt, but the one thing that definitely changes in my mind is by the time you get to the Gospels, and I'm not entirely unconvinced by the idea that maybe even the way Jesus is characterized in the Gospels has a lot to do with, modeled on Paul or Paul's letters. I think you can make a very convincing case that the author of the Gospel of Mark has read Paul. Few people that Luke has. I think that what you end up having, interestingly, Jesus does say like Mark 13, where he says the temple will fall very rarely. And, you know, he visits the temple, of, you know, as a child in Matthew. But other than that, you know, none of Jesus' teachings really require the temple. I don't see that as a repudiation of Judaism. I see that as, well, we have to reimagine what Judaism looks like today because the temple is gone, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's living in a world without the temple. Right. And Jesus is the metaphorical temple that replaces all those animal sacrifices and a very need for the temple.
Or at least the Gospels are used that way later.
Certainly, that's how it's interpreted later. Jesus' death, it can only be interpreted that way, obviously, after the war and the temple's gone. And in fact, that's one of the signatures that would tell us it's written after the war. But I absolutely agree. They perceive themselves as being part of Judaism. No matter how you slice it, this early Christian literature is directed at those who are interested in worshiping the Jewish God, whether they're Jews trying to assimilate into the Greco-Roman world or whether they're pagans who are interested in becoming God-fearers.
Yeah, that's the debate within Judaism too.
Right.
You know, before even the fall of the temple, you know, how much do we have to, you know, what would we say? You know, like once they're under the auspices of the Roman Empire, you know, do we have to learn Greek to be able to engage in commerce, right? Like, do we have to... you know, modernize, you know, some of our ideas, even about things like, I say modernize in a very loose sense, but, you know, we're there's somebody else who's in charge now, right? So if we're going, do we stay who we are historically, or do we start to, you know, adapt?
Right. Well, by the time we get to like the Gospel of John, Jesus is simply saying, my kingdom is not of this world.
Right.
The Messiah's kingdom is in another dimension altogether. But, you know, you have Romans 13, where Paul seems to very nakedly say that the Roman government are the very agents of God on earth, and that's why we have to obey them. You know, we pay our taxes, not just because it's a good practical idea of getting along. We do it out of conscience. The government, specifically the first century Roman government, apparently, are God's own agents here on earth. That's a very strong political...
It is strong, but I tend to... I default a little bit too much to this, but I tend to think about, like, you know, Paul's practical project, which is, you know, like he has to get people to listen to him. Not self-evident, right? Right? And also, like, you know, if you're trying to inculcate a movement, and, you know, he's not the only game in town. Mm-hmm. Like, we know he has these opponents and super apostles, whatever those are. Some of them even saying you need to circumcise to join this movement.
Right.
And he gets very mad at the Galatians for that.
Right.
Mad at other groups for that too. But you know, like I think about 1 Corinthians. I mean, I read him as, you know, being angry about things like speaking in tongues, not because he thinks that's necessarily a bad thing to do. I mean, it's a hop, skip, and a jump from claiming, you know, my joke is always like you're having, you know, tea parties with zombie Jesus. You know, like, right? But it's because. Like, don't look so weird from the outside. No one wants to be part of this group.
Right.
Like, you're just acting
need to be so weird.
You know, people are going to look at you like, what? You know, like, what? And already, I mean, this kind of brings us back to what we were just talking about. When we look at the Romans talking about Christianity, they're completely confused. It's a game of telephone. They're eating the body and the blood of the Son. What in the world?
What on earth are they talking about?
And so it's already, like, if you want to be legitimate, and that's what I think is the, you know, we call it an apologetic, but, you know, that's the Gospels, Acts of the Apostles, these texts, they're trying to show this was an amazing movement, right? This was self-evidently miraculous, wondrous.
Right.
Worthy of respect.
Right.
And it also looks very much like all the other religions being practiced in the ancient Mediterranean.
Right. But, you know, among different Jewish groups in the first and second centuries, there is a sharp right line divide. And there are some who are willing to go to extremes of violence, terrorism, war, to attain their independence.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And, there are other Jews who, like Paul apparently, who are taking a very, very different political approach that stands out, let me suggest, among Jews of the first two centuries, given the strong messianic beliefs. I mean, we can read this. They obviously started even before the first century of the Common Era, the sectarian documents of the scrolls suggest intense apocalyptic, intense messianic concern, even a militant one, a separatist one that obviously foreshadows the rebellions to come in the first and second centuries. And so that's what makes, say, Philippians all the more remarkable coming from the hand of Paul. He's saying, I have there's no one in the Imperial Guard here in Rome who hasn't heard the message. He had that kind of access to the Praetorian Guard that he's confident in telling the Philippians, yeah, I've spoken to every man jack of those guys in the Praetorian Guard. And, oh, by the way, greetings from Caesar's household. Now, I know those might be slaves or freedmen or people at the low end of Caesar's household, but just the mere fact that Paul apparently has contact with people, multiple people in Caesar's household in Rome, has access to the entire Praetorian Guard, is a remarkable, again, connecting to your thesis about this coming from elites, Paul seems to have pretty elite connections.
He does, but I mean, this is his objective, right? I mean, his goal, and I don't mean this in any kind of pejorative way, it's just, again, very practical. He's looking for sponsorship. You know, he's looking for somebody to basically bankroll his ability to interpret Jewish scripture, his ability to tell you more about this Jewish Messiah through these divination experiences he's having. He's looking for sponsorship to continue to travel. We know this from Romans. You know, we don't know if he ever makes it to Spain, but he's trying to at least make it to Rome and then to Spain. You don't ask for money for those things, for, you know, the collection for the saints in Jerusalem. You don't ask for money for those things from people who don't have money, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And travel expenses, you know, 2,000 years ago, I mean, getting to Spain is not cheap, you know.
Writing sending letters isn't cheap. I mean, he's not writing on ostraca. You know, some people would just write on pot shards, you know, like a postcard, because, you know, that was more affordable than papyri.
Right.
He's not, from best we can tell, writing, you know, in a cheap way either. You know, and I don't mean, again, cheap pejoratively, but he has greater means.
Right.
To do these things. And they're not all from his own money, although he is, by comparison, a wealthy individual in the ancient world, independently as a Pharisee. You know, he's been educated. He's from Tarsus, which is an important city in the ancient world for education. The Romans didn't tend to send their children there. They tended to send them to Greece to be educated. But Tarsus, everyone was well aware, was, you know, a city where there was great learning. Great knowledge of philosophy. So, you know, if those elements are true, you know, and we have no reason not to think so, at least to that degree, you know, he's a Pharisee from Tarsus. You know, he's well-educated, well-connected.
Right, right. No, I have no reason to, I agree with that conception entirely. I think Paul's main thrust is his message of, you know, the metaphysical importance of the death and resurrection of Jesus. And he is insisting that he got it from his own visions, not from some other guy. And he's insisting that to the people who apparently actually knew the historical Jesus, which takes a certain degree of chutzpah.
It definitely does. I can't imagine that conversation. I don't know why I find it so funny, but I do, you know, like he did have a lot of gall to go in. But, you know, just it's a testimony to presumably how much he believed he was telling the truth about the matter. So
he was certainly passionate about it. You know, there is also those points where I start to question Paul. I think he is intense about what he believes, but he'll say things like, to those under the law, I'm under the law. To those who aren't under the law, I'm not. You know, I'm all things to all men so I can win as many as possible.
Yeah.
He comes right out and says that.
Yeah.
So you wonder, you know, what are his motives and his agenda?
Well, I mean, again, you always have kind of the balance between the practical and, you know, taking him at his word. I mean, presumably, again, he disappears from the historical record. I understand this church, you know, doctrine about, or at least tradition about, you know, how he's killed in Rome. But, you know, that may or may not be the case. I've known some scholars to try to argue that he was actually killed in Ephesus. We don't know exactly what happens to him, but presumably he did die for this. So,
right.
You know, ultimately we have to keep that in mind too.
Yeah.
As far as his commentary on leadership, Roman leadership, and I would say this goes to the Gospels as well, you know, render unto Caesar's what is Caesar's, that kind of mentality. I almost read that as, if you think that Jesus is coming back with his heavenly army, right? Vanquish all archons, so enemies, you know, earthly rulers.
All those rulers.
Yeah, and institute a heavenly kingdom on earth. for, you know, the people who have recognized that this movement is afoot. Sure, pay your taxes. Because ultimately, what difference does it make, right? These leaders may think that they're strong, but it's coming for them, right? Like,
there's certainly a future apocalypse in which everyone is going to, you know, be judged. The quick and the dead are going to be judged here. That's central to Christian theology.
Yeah, it is. And but also the us versus them is essential for group cohesion. And so I'm not often too surprised by the rhetoric of, you know, ultimately a strong Roman leader is a weak Roman leader in an esoteric sense, right? Or at least, you know, in the face of the apocalypse.
It does seem astonishing in the book of Acts where we sort of follow Paul as he travels around, and it just seems so consistent that it is angry Jews who are after Paul, and angry Jewish mobs are constantly tailing him throughout.
What else are they going to be?
Well, his Torah critical message might offend a great many Jews, even to the extent he, as we've limited it, he saw himself certainly as a Jew. He saw himself as fulfilling, in effect, the Hebrew scripture, not violating it. I totally agree with you. But he is advocating a Torah critical perspective that might have been offensive to Torah Orthodox Jews of the time. So it makes some sense that that argument in Galatians should be reflected in the experience that we hear in Acts, where Jewish crowds are constantly tailing Paul in an angry way. But what's also interesting there is that Roman officials are constantly protecting Paul. It's a Roman clerk here, a Roman administrator here, a Roman here, and a Roman here, who are in Jerusalem, an entire cohort, we're told in Acts, of the Roman army is sent to protect Paul when a group of Jews are out to kill Paul. I don't know if that's historical. I don't place a lot of historical faith in the book of Acts, which I think is. But it's just an interesting tradition that's rather consistent in Acts, that the Roman government is protecting Paul and his journeys, and it's Torah Orthodox Jews who are sort of his opponents.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's not terribly surprising. I don't... you know, for a variety of reasons, geographic, you know, but depending on who you and when you think Acts is being written, right, at a time when you are looking for more distinction, right, as a standalone group, right?
Right, and there can be no question we have increasing anti-Semitism within the Christian.
And that's my anxiety, right? Yeah. Is that, you know, if we point out with vigor the degree to which we see Jewish opposition to Jesus, to Paul, that can be interpreted in an anti-Semitic way. That gives me anxiety because that, you know, kind of anachronistically reads into those texts political ideas that I find reprehensible today into texts of antiquity, where the nuances of the distinctions between Jewish groups, inter-Jewish dialogue, and even dialogue between God-fearers, between Romans, people we would call pagans and Jews, is much more complicated. And the rhetorical aims of these literary authors, often, you know, they can't anticipate what's going to happen, you know, in the mid 20th century, that would cause.
Exactly. But right, the truth is, we didn't have to wait to the 20th century for anti-Semitic horrors. That's passion play performances in the Middle Ages would routinely cause mob violence against the local Jewish community.
Oh, in Spain? Forced conversion. I mean, the history is long and it's horrible.
And it seems to me hard to deny that a good deal of Christian anti-Semitism over the last 2,000 years is rooted in that passion narrative.
Yes.
I mean, Matthew has the crowd actually say, his blood is on us and on our children, the very generation that would suffer in the first Jewish war.
Yeah, Hitler used that.
And anti-Semites for centuries have used that.
Right.
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the curious things. It is, I absolutely agree with you, these authors definitely perceive themselves, and at the time would have perceived themselves, as Jews. And yet what they're doing is they're blaming that generation. And in fact, that's what's sort of singled out in the literature. This generation is corrupt and awful and killed Jesus, and boy, they got their comeuppance in the Jewish war.
Well, but sometimes there's also been the interpretation of, I don't know how quite to put this, but it had to happen that way for the prophecy to be fulfilled. So it's almost like, you know, that the intentionality we ascribe to that group, you know, that they did this maliciously. Well, they had to do it because, if they didn't, the prophecy would not be fulfilled. And so as literary device, what I mean by that is as literary device to indicate, you know, how this remains an intra-Jewish movement and one that had to come to fulfillment, you know, it was required that this took place for it to, you know, align with prophecy, right?
Right.
And that's not an indictment on the Jewish people. That's
not me, of course, right?
That's a literary device. That's why I emphasized before, like, but we have to remember crucifixion, the Jewish people could not execute somebody by crucifixion. Right. That was ultimately a Roman punishment. And one right. that, you know, even from in Roman viewpoints, you know, the Romans recognized it as a Roman punishment. And
absolutely.
So when we do see some pushback by pagans, quote unquote, later on to Christianity, they can't quite understand, like, why would you know, criminals are executed this way by our own government. Why are you following a criminal, right?
Right, an executed criminal.
Right, and it wouldn't have been, oh, the Jews blame, you know, they wouldn't have gone that. It wouldn't have looked like that to them.
You're right. The pagan outsiders wouldn't have. The first thing, as you point out, would have been, white. So you're worshiping this criminal who was executed?
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's graffiti. You know, we can't quite date. It's called the name. Anaximenes, maybe, is the name. I'm trying to remember. But it's a graffiti that was found, I think, on the Palatine. I'm sorry if any of this is incorrect because it's just off the top of my head. But somebody scribbled a picture of a man on a cross with a donkey's head.
With a donkey's head, the very famous, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that has nothing to do with Judaism, right? Like that kind of imagery, it's coming from
exactly. Judaism.
So I just want us to be careful that we don't, you know, inadvertently
absolutely.
You know, align ourselves with an anti-Semitic.
Absolutely. Business. No. Yeah. That would be almost to adopt the worst Christian apologetic kind of position. And I don't mean to blame Christians as all being anti-Semites either. I want to be careful about that.
Yeah, but that's why we do these shows, right? To be able to talk about this, talk about the text, the motivations of these authors, and try
right.
to, again, put them in context.
In the first century, as an
author writing these gospels, there were a panoply of different motivations and social historical context that motivate some of those choices. And it's our job to unravel the 2000 years of interpretation politics, you know, that have gone into the way that sometimes that is, I would say, misunderstood today. And so I think the more we can do that.
I think that's true. Yeah. The point you make is fundamental here. In the first couple of centuries, Christians wouldn't have even seen themselves. I mean, perhaps certain Marcionites are dumping their Hebrew roots altogether. But apart from that, Christians in the first two centuries would have simply seen themselves as Jews.
Or themselves with, again, you know, Judaism was interesting. Still,
right.
Yeah. It was an interesting ancient religion.
And with Neoplatonism on the rise, you see sort of this philosophical monotheism growing in the Greco-Roman world, and it sort of dovetails with it neatly,
very
doesn't
neatly.
It?
Yeah.
So there would be Roman, total, just educated, interested Romans. What is this monotheism thing?
Totally. I mean, Paul's a Middle Platonist. He's one of our only ones. You know, he takes Platonism.
Exactly right.
And he takes, you know, the physics of Stoicism and he couples them together. And, you know, this is why I like to emphasize there's some practical elements here. You know, when you go to a non-Jew to try to explain these ancient texts, yeah, they're interesting. But like, why are you going to believe him that, you know, like that's a big ask. What Paul's asking is a big ask, you know, the world is coming.
Yeah,
you know, and so, but he's using, I often tell my students, the best science of his day to prove it, Stoicism, right? And so he's able to, and many of the tenets of Stoicism, which include things like a high God, correspond beautifully with Judaism. And so he's able to couple these things together.
It's practically impossible to not see the Plato and the Stoicism
throughout
the New Testament and early Christian literature, starting with Paul.
You can't understand healing in Mark without Middle Platonism.
Exactly. It's as you point out, it's perhaps our most quintessential example of Middle Platonism.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, we have so few Middle Platonists. There's an author named John Dillon, a scholar named John Dillon, who I think in the 70s put together a collection of the Middle Platonists. I don't think he includes Paul, but there's only like six, right? Like, they're just not
there, though, doesn't he?
But
really, Paul belongs there, though, doesn't
he? He belongs there. Philo belongs there.
Right.
Yeah, I think they definitely belong there. And, you know, it also goes a long way to explaining why this was intelligible to non-Jews in the first century and why it was compelling and why Paul was convincing.
Right.
Why even the Gospels would have been interesting.
Right.
It's a level of the discourse we no longer detect because we're not all Middle Platonists. We see the translations of the words that have gone through Latin translation, now English translation, right? We don't see the Greek. And so if you're, say, a classicist who reads Greek first, then comes to the New Testament, of course you're going to read and be like, well, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course.
Yeah, but we don't read it that way anymore.
See, this is, Professor Walsh, I want to thank you very much. This is exactly the wonderful value that your work is. All of these things and qualifications you've made today have just been sparkling and wonderful to me.
Oh, that's kind. I mean, I have to say, I'm not the first one to say it. I mean, there are scholars. I mentioned Trolsingberg Peterson before, Stanley Stowers, Jennifer Eyal, Aaron Roberts, Paul Robertson. There are a lot of scholars who have worked on this and done excellent work on it too.
You brought it together and stated it in such a persuasive way.
I just wrote the dissertation last.
Well, you could, but that allowed you to have perspective and bring so many wonderful elements together as well, along with your own perspective.
I've benefited from my colleagues too.
Very appreciative of your work. I think, as I say, all of our listeners should go check it out. It's just powerful food for thought, people.
Thank you.
Thank you.